Please welcome back to the stage, Director Matt Wolf.
The question is if I had any issues with rights to music, and of course, yes. I think I made a lot of creative decisions about what music to use, but the ownership of it and the accessibility and the cost also was part of that decision-making process. But I feel good about the body of music that's in the film. But, you know, because Arthur was so desperate for studio time, he would often make a record. You know, he would record a record on the bill of a record company, for instance, Go Bang, which was just too central not to include in the film, you know, was recorded on somebody else's bill, and he ended up not owning the publishing or the master of it, and then those record companies go out of business, and it filters down through a chain of anonymous people. But a lot of the material is still controlled by Autica Records, which is kind of an extension of his estate, and that was the majority of the material that we were working.
I was kind of amazed how much footage you had of him, like, listening to his Walkman on the boat and stuff, and I'm just wondering where all that came from. Who took all the pictures and films?
The question was about the footage of Arthur on the Staten Island Ferry, and that's not real archival footage. That's footage that we shot. I purchased, like, a VHS camera off eBay from the early 80s, and I shot a lot of material on Super 8, and these are kind of like evocative reenactments that exist as a kind of fake archival material because there wasn't much material of Arthur, so we had to kind of get creative in terms of bringing him to life.
As far as archival stuff, I noticed that David Toop obviously was a central guy that didn't know Arthur, but he was one of the few journalists that actually got to interview Arthur back in the day. I'm just wondering how helpful he was in sort of presenting an outsider's perspective rather than a lot of friends and stuff sort of talking about him throughout the movie.
The question is about David Toop, the British man in the black shirt who looks serious, and he was one of the few people who got to interview Arthur, and there was another journalist named Frank Owen who did a great interview with Arthur, and you know, I think in this film I was trying to avoid a lot of the traps of a music documentary with too many talking heads and, from my opinion, to just too much technical detail about music and musical process, but I did feel like there needed to be an outside figure who could provide some sort of analysis or kind of cultural reading of the significance of Arthur's music. And David Toop, I thought, was unlike most journalists in the sense that he has this kind of sweeping, free associative, brilliant, rigorous kind of way of thinking. He wrote a book called Ocean of Sound, which brings together so many disparate things, and his kind of critical perspective, I thought, was really in line with Arthur's way of making music and art. So that's why I chose to use David as, you know, the expert, because he was not a traditional kind of expert. Any other questions? Yeah, a new record is going to be coming out in September, and it's going to be called Love is Overtaking Me, and a lot of the music that hasn't been released, that's in the film, is going to be on that record. It's going to be mainly kind of country folk songs. It's a whole other body of work that has nothing to do with disco or World of Echo, so that should be out in the fall at some point. Is that it? Oh, no. Yeah, totally. And we were very consciously trying to build momentum on the internet with the film because we knew that there was this fan base that was so international, and we wanted to start developing our kind of audience. But also, like, the clip of Arthur performing with David Byrne like a fan emailed me and told me about that. That's how we found that. And Arthur's childhood friends contacted me, and one of them told me all the books he was reading, and I got those exact books issued from the same years to recreate his childhood bedroom, and you know, stuff, details like that. A lot of that came to me. I was pursuing it, but it also kind of fell in my lap sometimes too. So yeah, the internet aspect of it was important for us.
I think you admitted something. I don't know if it was on purpose or not, but he went to the Manhattan School of Music.
Yeah.
There's a whole part there, and I don't know, you like, it was kind of like his classical training. I don't think he graduated, but he did some performances and things like that.
Exactly. The question was about, you know, why isn't there information about Arthur's time at the Manhattan School of Music? That's where he was classically trained. And there's a lot that's missing from the film. It's definitely, part of the reason I call it a portrait is because I don't see it as this kind of definitive record. And I wanted to do things that I felt had emotional resonance or that I could bring to life visually. And one anecdote that I think is particularly important that's left out of the film is that Arthur recorded with John Hammond Sr., who was a very prominent A&R person in American music, and signed, you know, he recorded with Bob Dylan and signed Billie Holiday. It was really important to Arthur that he was able to do that, but there was no way to really bring that to life, and it was hard to translate the significance of that in the film. And I think a lot of anecdotes that are important get left out for those reasons, and I tried to focus on just doing this kind of core portrait and really touching upon the key kind of emotional and creative aspects of Arthur's work and life. But what you're saying is true, that there was an important aspect of him having some classical training as well.
Will any of that music come out available? More of the cello music, more of the sort of non-folk, non-disco?
Yeah, there is a record that is out called First Thought, Best Thought, and that includes instrumentals, which is music that there's a scene in the film that explores, and also Tower of Meaning, which is the music that was composed for Robert Wilson that didn't get used. And then this past week in New York, we did a special screening of the film at the Kitchen, and it was tied into a weekend-long tribute to Arthur that involved music performances. And part of that was music for large ensembles that was conducted and played by many of the musicians who originally worked with Arthur. And there was a whole body of work called The Singing Tractors, and I had never heard that music myself, and I just heard it last night, and it's incredible, and it's in the same vein as instrumentals, but it's just kind of complex, you know, minimalist avant-garde composing with pop kind of essence to it. And I don't know if you'll ever hear it or not, but there's so much material that is yet to be discovered.
Do you find contemporary musicians and artists taking up Arthur's works and performing it?
Yeah, there have been a number of contemporary musicians who have covered Arthur's work. Jens Lekman, the Swedish musician, organized a kind of covers project that Joel Gibb from the Hidden Cameras from Toronto participated in, and so did Verity Sussman from Electrolane, and Victoria Bergsman from Taken by Trees, and Tracy Thorne of Everything But the Girl has done a cover, and the list kind of goes on. And that was kind of part of the weekend at the Kitchen, was to recognize that this new generation is interested in Arthur, besides the ensemble music that was performed, there was solo artists like Joel Gibb who were there performing covers. So I think, you know, Arthur's legacy is peaking right now. I feel like we're in the midst of a renaissance of people discovering his music.
How did you come to choose this as a subject?
I had a friend in San Francisco who said, "You're going to be really into this." And just his description alone was totally compelling to me. He said, "There's this gay disco auteur who used to ride the Staten Island Ferry every day listening to cassettes of his own mixes." And that image kind of itself had me pretty hooked. And then when I heard the music, I got really obsessed with it. And I contacted Tom Lee. I found found him on the internet because I wanted to ask for permission to make just a kind of visual short film. But when I met Tom, I was so kind of inspired by him, and his connection to Arthur seemed so alive and real that it occurred to me that there could be, you know, a biographical dimension to the project. And so that led me to the Russells, and it was clear I had to go to Iowa, and this film started unraveling and becoming this much bigger and more ambitious thing. It looks like we have time for one more question. Anyone got a good one? Okay, back.
On his lyrics, when they were kind of hard to understand, did you have anybody that knew of writing his lyrics down or that could understand what he was singing?
In some of his records that are released today, there are liner notes like Another Thought and Calling Out of Context. And, you know, some of them aren't, like World of Echo. Tom and Steve Knutson from Autica have done their best to kind of retrace them. Arthur used to keep little notepads in his breast pocket, and they were like, he had hundreds of them, all of little scribbles of notes, and I've gone through a lot of them. It's really interesting. And before we leave, I just want to plug that we're having a party tonight at the Beaver, and I hope you can all come on Queen Street West. I forget the exact address, but I feel like a lot of you probably know where that is. And we'll be there around 10 or something. So thank you so much for coming.